I mean, there was a key point when I approached Anthony Hopkins. He agreed to do it, and then he changed his mind. I think I wrote to him saying, how dare you, how dare you let me down, you know.
If you lead an interesting life, good pictures will happen.
Oh, nice. You might well be my sexiest sounding guest.
Go somewhere you've never been before and take a camera.
We had this gorgeous Mediterranean light just flowing in.
Which as do we win?
A Dartford.
Very nice.
Your first 10,000 pictures are your worst.
Let's sit down, let's have a cup of tea.
Welcome to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to another episode of the Standout Photography Show with me, Matthew Walker, where, as always, it is my honour and privilege to interview the finest working photographers in the world to unpack their systems, workflows, and find out what enables them to perform consistently at the very top of their profession. My guest today is Simon Anand. That is at Simon Anand Photography on Instagram and simonanand.com on the World Wide Webs. That is Anand, A-N-N-A-N-D. Simon has been a photographer for over 30 years, focusing on all aspects of the theatre, including production and rehearsal photographs, posters, headshots, editorial commissions, and his own project, The Half, about actors preparing for the stage. The Half is a book published by Faber and Faber and an exhibition toured by the V&A in London, Paris, New York, and Moscow since 2008. His career has seen him photograph some of the most famous faces of both stage and screen, including Judi Dench, who said, "Simon is one of the most amazing photographers I have had the pleasure of working with. The results speak for themselves." Mark Rylance, who said, "Cheers, Simon, wonderful to work with you." And Mr. John Hanna, who said, "Really enjoyed the session. The most interesting photo shoot I've ever done." Yeah. High praise indeed. So, without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with the wonderful Simon Anand. It's a real pleasure to say, Simon Anand, welcome to the show.
Thank you for asking me to be with you.
No, absolute pleasure. I have been a huge fan of your work for a long time, so I'm absolutely thrilled to be speaking with you. Before we came on air, you mentioned that you began your career at 28, 29 years of age. You clearly have a huge, huge passion for the theatre, and I wondered, what were you doing before you took the plunge to become a photographer in the theatre?
Wasting my 20s, basically. trying to. I'm one of those classic cases who. It's a long story. I started off as a Christian. Mainly because I was told of a monastery on a hill in Burgundy when I was about 16, 17, and having been packed off to an all-boys boarding school at the monastery, it was a sort of modern place where lots of young people from around the world came to sleep for a week or two in tents on top of this gorgeous hill attached to the monastery, and I went off there for 3 or 4 years to meet girls, basically, but also, of course, to be a Christian. It was fantastic fun, and I went from being a Christian then to discover that there was such a thing called class, and I was middle class, and went to work in the East End of London to find out about a few things, and discovered that I was a very bad social worker because I was, you know, too liberal, basically, and the kids I was working with wanted someone to be strict with them. And then so I went off to study about politics and philosophy for about 3 years at Bristol, and then committed myself to working in shops and bars to try and understand how to do that, because I knew it was a difficult job to serve people in that way. And then my mother died, and I thought it was about time to wake up and concentrate and focus on something, which turned out to be photography. I went on holiday, borrowed a camera and went on holiday and came back, having taken my first photographs, and my eldest brother said, "Hey, hang on a moment. These are more than just snaps. You know, you've got something here," and it opened up the possibility of exploring it. And I linked it to the theatre because that was my other passion at the time.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned theatre, because that is where your work is focused. Did you ever have a passion to be in the theatre, as in on the stage?
I did. I never wanted to be an actor, but I do have a secret regret, which I really wanted to direct in the theatre, the camera. I invented that I was a photographer, and the first opportunity came in 1983 when Yuri Lubimov came to the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith to do his version of Crime and Punishment. I was so wowed by this charismatic man in Hammersmith after having spent 2 years on the bar pulling pints very badly. I gave up the bar job, pretended I was a photographer, and asked him if he would take me in to photograph the rehearsals, which he did, and I created a small exhibition of 60 pictures out of that six-week experience. He shared the view that having a photographer in the rehearsal room was of use and interest to the process, because it showed the actors what they were doing from a photographer's point of view every Friday at the end of the week. And they would put up on the walls some of my pictures, which I hastily got together, having taught myself how to develop film in a bathroom and a cupboard, like most people do, I think, and carry off this impersonation of being a photographer. But I was really there to enjoy and learn from this great man and how he was directing the actors. It turned out that he was the kind of Russian director who overdid it a bit, because English actors don't like to be, they don't like the action or the gesture or the scene to be demonstrated to them by the director. But Yuri had been the Olivier of Russia. He's a great actor as well before he became a director, so he was capable of doing that. So there was a bit of tension between him and the company, because the English actors like to, I guess, discover it for themselves. And most of the English directors are not actors, certainly in that time in 1983.
I really enjoy that you said you made up that you were a photographer. When you approached him, did he ask to see any of your previous work, or did you?
Fortunately, no, he didn't. This is quite remarkable. I think he's one of those people. There are a few people I met in my life. He's one of them. He looks you in the eye, and you try to look back directly, and he can tell if you're bluffing. You know, I mean, if he can trust you, but not if you're bluffing, because I was bluffing. But he can trust you. Why? What's your motivation to want a connection to what he's doing? And I was perfectly genuine about it. I loved theatre and I wanted to know about it more. So he let me in. He didn't actually need to see any images to prove it.
So following that six-week stint, was that when you realised, you said you'd spent a lot of time kind of whiling away the hours in your 20s, did you realise that after those 6 weeks, this is the course and the path that you were destined to be on, so to speak, as a photographer?
Well, I was probably about 27 at the time. I've forgotten, to be honest. Maybe 25, 26, I don't know. But I then, it didn't give me the, it was 5 years before I actually got paid for doing a photography job. So I actually went away after I'd left the Lyric as a barman to become a gardener. With some interesting gardeners to get money. And in 85, I did a second exhibition around another production that was at the Lyric Theatre Hammersmith, The House of Bernard Alba, which is quite a famous production directed by Nuria Esper, who was the leading Spanish director at the time. And it had Glenda Jackson and Joan Plowright in the cast. So I was really interested to try and repeat a bit of rehearsal photography into an exhibition for this production, which I did. And then it was another 2 years before I got to the Old Vic with Jonathan Miller, and I could show Jonathan prints from the two previous exhibitions, so he knew that I wasn't wasting his time. But I had started a personal project that I've got called The Half, about actors in the dressing room before they go on stage, did start in 1982-83. So the first 5 or 6 years of that were as a kind of keen enthusiast, you know, rather than being a professional paid photographer. It just seemed natural to me to do. And when I sort of told people that I was going to do this, people said, well, do you realize there are 10,000 photographers in London? You know, it's a bit of a long shot. And it didn't, it's like water off a duck's back to me. It just felt so good to do it. I didn't question myself on that level. Just went ahead and did it.
I'm glad you mentioned your work on The Half, because we're going to come on to that a little bit later on. Most of your work, obviously being in the theatre, is on location. You're in theatres. But what does your workspace look like when you get back, when you bring the images back and you work on them before delivering them? What does your space look like?
Yeah, now that's changed, obviously. From I did 21 years of film. And since 2003, it's been digital. So in the film days, it was a palaver. You know, you had to come home and process the stuff, you know, and dry it and get the legs right, and then you had to print it out. It was quite laborious to do, quite romantic, I suppose, in the old-fashioned way. But I'm very thankful for the digital era, because you can come home and download these things called files and JPEGs, and they're there in front of you. And so instead of going into a darkroom, these days I will do what most photographers do, is sit down at the computer, download, and start working on the post-production work, listening to all sorts of music, which I adore, and sometimes you have to stay up till 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning to meet the deadline for the next day, but that's fine.
You mentioned then that you often listen to music when you're working. I do that as well, because I feel it, that they somehow work very, very well with one another.
Mm.
What kind of music would you listen to, or does it depend on what you're editing?
It does depend on what you're editing, but also your frame of mind, you know. I mean, the word eclectic is often used by people about their musical tastes, but I mean, quite often I find piano sonatas by Haydn, Mozart, Bach, and Beethoven really, really good for that kind of work. I'm a big jazz fan, because you can, depending on the kind of jazz that you choose, but it's not something that's going to impose itself on me, you know, that demands my attention. You can sort of, you know, it's music which sets a high standard of music, which is important to me. When I get into the period of the post-production where I feel need a bit of a sort of emotional lift, I might put on some grungy sort of Irish music or singer-songwriters, that sort of thing. By that stage, I know that I've got about only an hour or two left before I can handle it. I have to go to sleep or something.
I'd like to also talk about, you mentioned in the early days you used to work on film. Where did you go? Because presumably you are self-taught as a photographer. Where did you go in the early days to learn that skill? Because it's a real skill. Digital is a lot easier nowadays for people like myself to learn. You know, we've got the internet, we've got things like that.
Yeah.
Where did you go in the early days?
Well, I may have attended maybe a couple of evening classes, maybe right back in sort of 82-83, but it's fairly, I mean, in those days you didn't have a choice, so you had to pay attention if you're attending a class. And I made lots of mistakes, you know. I'm in the when I look back at the archives of my negs, my film negs these days, I can see that I didn't wash the fixer off enough, or it's something like that. You know, you can see it eating into the emulsion of the film. But that's mostly you can revise that with software these days. But I made the decision to go into digital was vital, because I mean, I remember having a job with the National Theatre in 2003, and the press officer said to me, you know, can you send me the JPEGs tomorrow or something? And I didn't know what a JPEG was. So I had to sort of rediscover all this language. And my personal view is that one had to get into it at that point, because you would have lost loads of work. There are a few very, very fantastically talented theatre photographers who are just a bit older than me, who never made this jump. They just can't take on the digital because it doesn't suit them, and they can't get any work at all, which is a shame. But going into the digital landscape, you know, at the time there were lots of debates at the time about, is it real photography or the old style was much more skillful, and I don't personally agree with that. I think I shoot towards my software, and I don't use it as a safety net. Or, you know, I might every now and again, but not on, as a rule. You have to know, you know, you can make a good picture great, but you can't make a bad picture very good. You know, you have to know what the narrative is before you, what you want to say before you take the picture, in my view. And when you get to the software point of using Photoshop or whatever it is, you know, you've got so many choices that you can make. You can get quite a few of them wrong, as people do, and there's good Photoshop and bad, less good Photoshop, putting like that. And it's quite an art to illuminate the story through the software without people realizing that it's been done, if you see what I mean. It's not cheating, it's just, you know, you're not trying to draw attention to the Photoshop skills of the photography, you're trying to draw attention to what the image is, you know, as a whole.
You've mentioned two things that I wanted to touch on there, actually. One of them is your workflow. Now, you mentioned Photoshop. What does the journey look like when you, from the moment you take the card out of the camera to delivering the images, what does your workflow look like? Obviously, you use Photoshop. Do you use Lightroom? Do you use Bridge?
I use Bridge and Photoshop. I'm probably backward in this respect. I'm not aware of any of the software that might have come out that could be easier to use. I'm not sure. My personality is conservative with a small C. I have the camera that I've had. It's been for, you know, I usually have one for 10, 15 years, and then when it's done, like my cars, you know, you get another one. But if I choose, you know, well in the first place, I don't tend to, I don't feel that my photography is defined by the technology or the software that I'm using. That's a personal choice. The photographs are in your head, or my head anyway. So with Photoshop, I've mined it. I've probably got quite an old version, but essentially it's all the same. And you have revelations in your working life, like, if you're working on your own, the things that you discover that help you, like going from levels to curves, for example, was a big shift for me, the subtlety with curves. And then you've got to learn how to use a curve. And if you're under pressure in a deadline, the more you practice, the more skillful you become, I guess. But I'm not trying to use Photoshop to show off at all, you know, the tricks and the things like that. I could do better, I guess. But I mean, I've done quite a few exhibitions myself, you know, post-production and printing myself. The printing thing has been a real struggle to get the, you know, if you are tempted to make shortcuts with, you know, you buy cheaper inks or you don't match the paper with the inks or the printer, it did become a nightmare for me. So I tend to pay more and use the inks that the I use a Canon printer that they supply, and so all the profiles match up, and it's much, much easier, especially, you know, especially with color, because it, but I bring to that what I learned in the film world, you know, using color film, because you have to know about magenta and all that sort of stuff.
So if you are doing an exhibition now, you will do all of your own printing for that exhibition?
I do that, yes. There are advantages and disadvantages. The advantages are that it saves the venue, the gallery, even if it's the V&A or whoever it is, it saves on the budget, firstly. Secondly, you cut out all the stuff where you have to negotiate with a professional printer, however good they are. You know, they always have their own way of doing it, and if it's not the same as yours, you've got to go through all that stuff. So you don't have to do that. Disadvantages are, I suppose, it takes the time, and there's a limit to the sizes that I can print here. You know, if it's going to go out really big, it's got to go to a lab, really.
So as well as printing, will you mount the images as well? Will you frame them, or do you send them to be done elsewhere?
I wouldn't do any of that, no.
You mentioned as well about making mistakes, and as you said, I'm a huge fan of mistakes because it's how we learn, providing you don't make them twice, obviously. What is your... What's the best mistake you've made as a photographer?
Yeah, you put that in the questions. I wasn't quite sure. It's a clever question. I'm not quite sure how to answer it. Best mistake. I mean, I think you're right that you shouldn't be afraid of making mistakes. And my father said, it's not the mistakes you make, it's what you make of your mistakes, which is useful in life.
I like that. Sorry, say that again.
It's not the mistakes you make, it's what you make of your mistakes. In other words, it's the consequence of
your mistake. Of course.
But in photography, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the obvious mistakes, like in the film days, you put in the same roll of film twice, you know, on a job that you can't repeat, and you come out with two sets of pictures over 36 frames, which is, of course, unusable. But then you might, depending on what the job was, you might actually think, well, that's quite funky, some of the stuff that came through there, but it wasn't intentional. I've probably made all the mistakes and hopefully only done it once, as you say. You know, that's the thing. You've got to learn from what you've done wrong. But as a self-taught person, there's nobody standing over me who's either guided me through, you know, when you make a technical mistake, you have to take on board the fact that you messed up within yourself. So it's a bit like an actor. It's okay. It's lovely when they get work, but you have to survive when you don't get work. You have to manage yourself. And the ones who keep going and get through are the ones who've been through that experience, you know. With photography, I mean, if you make technical mistakes, people turn around and tell you you're an idiot, but you then have to realize, you have to want to go on. That's what makes you a photographer.
Are you someone that enjoys learning on the job and learns better on the job versus being taught, for example?
What was the last bit?
For me personally, I feel that my personality is suited to learning on the job. I enjoy it a lot more than if I, for example, had gone to university and sat in a classroom and listened to somebody, I think. Mm. And I guess it's half the reason that I'm speaking to you now is that I enjoy speaking to other people who are experienced and know their stuff.
Mm.
Are you someone that prefers to learn on the job?
I totally agree with you. I've got quite a lot to say about that, which is, surprise, surprise. I mean, I think the modern culture suffers from what happened in the 1960s. In the 1960s, they opened up loads of courses, which on the face of it are fantastically sharing the information, and information is power and so on. But of all the architects and the painters and the photographers and the actors and that have been people who've studied to do those disciplines and gone through the colleges, they've come out, and there's far too many of them, in a way, for the amount of work that's available. That's the first thing. And therefore, in the old days, certainly in acting, there were drama schools, but on the whole, you did learn as you did it. You know, as you performed, you got the job, you learned on the job. And that the advantage of doing that is that your personality develops in line with your skills. So if you go to a college and you're submitted to a syllabus for three or four intense years, you know, you get your skills may improve, but they're not in line with your personality. So you, in a way, you haven't earned the right to know what it is you've been told. And the pressure is on you as well in your 20s. And most of the great artists of any kind, except physical disciplines, certainly in photography and in art, you know, painting and so on, have usually done their mature best work in their 40s, when they've got something to say. You know, they've got, they've earned the place within their personality to put it through their art. And these days I find there's a lot of very thin sort of work, which of course suffers from the postmodernist period when the modernists had sort of finished and then nobody knew what to do, so they started sampling other people's work and they thought that was original to do that. And in architecture, of course, you know, they'd quote from different periods within the same building. It was just a mess, mostly. Music has done something similar. And all the people since the end of modernism have been looking fondly back at the modernist, which is the definition of which is someone who has a vocation to do something. They do it all their life, and their contribution to culture is a particular personal way of looking at human nature, which is uniquely their own, which is the modernist way of looking at it. And all the postmodernists secretly, you know, fondly look back at the modernist and want to be a modernist. But philosophy and politics have exploded, you know, that idea because it's seen as elitist. And so, anyway, you know what I mean?
I do. And if we could look at your theatre work, because a lot of your work is production shots. You also do headshots and, of course, the half. When you're doing production photography, how do you like to prepare for that? And I know that can obviously change depending on the director's vision and things like that and how much access you can get. But in an ideal world, how would you like to prepare for production photography?
I personally, you mentioned headshots, for example, and I also, you haven't mentioned weddings, but I do love doing headshots and weddings for people. I don't think it's beneath, you know, I don't think it's a lower form of photography. And I've been fortunate enough to do half a dozen weddings of friends, direct friends or indirect friends, and some of them have been really interesting over the years, sort of half a dozen a year. So I've done God knows how many that comes to, but it's a very unique experience because all the stories of the people who are coming together are there on in one place, and you have to be very skillful to know how to make that wedding look like itself, you know. And it's the same with theatre photography. Every show should look like itself. So if you've photographed 10 seagulls, the seagull by Chekhov or cherry orchard by Chekhov or something, the thing is to make it specific to the decisions that the director has made in the rehearsal room to put their version out there. So in order for me as the photographer to be in tune with that, the director's rhythm, I will read a script and attend, read through if possible, to get to know actors, the company at that point, because it's the most positive point and everybody's up before anything goes wrong. And you can sort of mingle with the company so that when it comes to the dress rehearsal, you're not someone out there who's taking pictures who's separate from them. They trust you. And the way I think of taking pictures of live performances are that if you know the decisions the actor is making and you take a picture to mark the decision that they've made, they won't even notice you're there because it seems logical to take a picture of that decision. You know, so that you're in tune with their performance. And the other thing is you have to earn the right to take a picture. You know, if you just set the camera off all the time, bang, 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 it doesn't fall into their rhythm at all. It's a lazy way of taking pictures, I think, to take too many.
Yes, and I really enjoy that element of understanding why an actor has done something, and which allows you to then capture that moment. And you would only know that had you been part of the company, as you said.
Mm.
I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about fairly prestigious, high-profile productions here. You know, when you're going to give you a certain amount of time to make sure you get it right. And if you spend time because the money's there, I don't charge by the hour, I just charge a fee. But if it's £1,000 or £2,000 or something, you know, it's a privilege to be there anyway. So I'm not going to start overcharging. But you might go down the pub with them in week 1, 2, 3, or 4 and just get to know each other and the trust builds. And, I mean, photography as a form has been through a bit of a crisis because I don't know whose fault it is. But if you look back at 1900 or even 1880 or something, and you look at the photographs of people then, the relationship between the subjects and the photographer is entirely different from what it is now. And I suppose the subjects in the old days didn't know what a camera could do, depending on who's holding the camera. But these days, for example, you know, 1997 with the car crash of Princess Diana, that was a very, you know, at that point historically, it was a big shift in the way that people saw photographers. And so a lot of the time, unfortunately, a photographer is thought of as being guilty and has to prove themselves innocent, which is not a position I like to be in. So to avoid that, I will make sure that in the theatre I'm trusted and, you know, and I get to know what they're doing before I go anywhere near a dress rehearsal, because the dress rehearsal is a tricky time for an actor. You know, it's the first time they're really getting up there and everything's, you know, a lot of people enjoy it, but some people, you know, if they're not confident with the decisions that have been made for the performance, you know, they don't want a photographer who doesn't know what they're doing, who's present and witnessing the action. So,
do you think that?
Does that make sense?
Yes. No. It does. It does. It was just interesting you mentioned then about the relationship between the photographer and the subject. Do you think that's evolved with the digital age as well? Because when everyone was shooting on film, for example, you naturally spent longer with the subject because of the way you were shooting. So you built you built more of a relationship rather than an SD card now where you can, you know, snap 1,000 images very quickly.
Yeah, well, this may be true, but I don't spend a lot of time with other photographers as such, or witness them working. So I couldn't comment on what they do. But it's related to the idea that of the death of photography, because everyone's taking a picture and you can do it on your phone and so on. And millions of people are doing it. But I personally think, when the pen was invented, whenever that was, which is a revolutionary advance on how to record information, and therefore a lot of people felt threatened that the monks or whoever couldn't keep their position of power because the information was exclusive, so everyone could write it down and so on and so on. But at the same time, it didn't create a lot of poets all of a sudden. You know, in other words, in photography, it's just as difficult to take an iconic picture as it ever was, because you have to understand what you're taking a picture of, and there aren't that many people who take the time over, you know, a large chunk of their life to focus on being a photographer. People can take fantastic images. For example, new parents often take wonderful pictures of the babies that have been born. But if you send them out to do something else, they may not be able to achieve that level. You know, so you need people around. It's like the reviewers, and I suppose they feel under threat at the moment, the professional reviewers in the theatre, because everyone's offering a review of something. But the ones who've done it for a long, long time and know their subject can usually provide a standard of a criticism which is informed and illuminates a piece in the light of all the other things that they've seen over a period of time. Yeah.
I do. And I'm glad you mentioned the relationship between the photographer and the subject and taking time to get to know somebody. Your headshots are, I said it to you the other day, and I've been looking since we spoke. There's a real honesty to them. They feel very open and uncomplicated. There's no clutter in the background. It's all about the actor. How long has it taken you to develop that style?
Well, yeah, you know, it goes back to what we were saying earlier, that it's learning on the job. So my understanding of working with actors in the first place and humans as subjects in the second place has developed in line with my own development as a human being, you know, as a person. I've been through a lot of stuff in my personal life, and I think I'm probably, hope, which is what it should be, I'm a better photographer now than I ever was, just because I understand more about what's in front of me, you know. And with actors' headshots, I think there are three ways in which they might be less effective than they could be. One is when the photographers tried to flatter the actor, which is a kind of glossy approach, which is not as I would never do unless asked. The second way is if the photographer has tried to make the actor look like an actor, which is a generic approach, which is pretty much useless, because when you go to a film, when you see a film or a play, you don't want to see actors acting. You want to see men and women telling a story. And the third way is if the photographer has imposed his or her own style upon the picture. So it's more about the photographer than it is about the subject. And my starting point is a different one, which is to ask the question, what do casting directors find useful in a headshot? And my answer would be images of men and women who happen to be actors, with the authority in their face to tell a story. And in the UK style of acting, one of the primary strengths is the sense of character. Character acting. It's another tool to describe aspects of human nature. And so I concentrate on the face, which is an instrument through which is coming a load of thoughts and feelings and presence that the actor's involved in. So I tend to direct the actors into certain places so that the resonance is coming into the face from behind it, in the person's mind. And it's all very subtle on the surface, you know, hopefully, because it's a big close-up in film terms, so you can't do anything too big. I will say to the actor before the session starts, I'm going to be quite tough with them, if that's okay with them, to push them hard. And I refer to the film Whiplash, which a lot of people have seen, actors, and they like it, of the young man who wanted, who was 19, I think, he wanted to be the best jazz drummer in the world. So he went to a very tough teacher. The teacher understood that to be a really good jazz drummer, especially in a big band, the drummer has to supply, the rest of the band relies on the drummer to supply a constant and reliable tempo. If the tempo is out, you know, the whole band can't operate. And with the actors, they have to be present in the scene for the resonance to be evident. So I push them quite hard in that way.
How long will you typically spend with an actor during the session?
Ideally, half a day. Sometimes it's more tricky. It'll be longer because each person who comes through the door who I've never seen before will bring something along, you know, with them that's on their mind. I mean, that's not a bad thing because that's what you're photographing, their mind. But, for example, a man in his 50s once came along, I think around 9:30 in the morning, and in the previous 2 months, his father had died, his brother had committed suicide, and his wife was divorcing him. So the emotions in his real life were very close to the surface. So, you know, that's an extreme example, but everyone brings something, like they might have broken up with their partner that day or something, or the day before. And the point is, it's like with actors in the dressing rooms, when they have to go on in the into the building in the evening and play somebody else, they take with them what they have done during the day. And that isn't a hindrance, it's the material. You know, you work with what's inside somebody's mind, what's on their mind, and you encourage them to express it, and a great deal of trust is involved.
Is there a correlation between your production photography and your headshots? I mean, where does your business come from, I guess, is my question, because you've had some very high-profile people come to you for headshots, Mark Rylance being a prime example, Benedict Cumberbatch, James Norton. These are wonderful actors. Have they come to you because you've photographed them during a production? Have they come to you off a recommendation from your website? Do you know where that where they
I
come can't, from?
I suppose I'm fortunate that all the three strands of income dovetail into each other. The constant factor is probably the trust involved, and secondly, that they want to be seen in whatever context it is, the dressing room, on the stage, or as a headshot, through my eyes, I guess. I mean, that's the way I operate. You know, so a photographer will only find what he or she is looking for. And in my case, I'm really not trying to be predatory or, you know, clever or ironic. I just want to give them, in the depending on the context, what is required. You know what I mean? So the headshots have benefited hugely from my knowledge and good fortune to work with some of the best directors in the world in the theatre, to mention a few, Peter Brook and Anatoly Vasiliev, for example. And they are people who understand what motivates an actor as opposed to a sculptor or a writer. So I've often thought of the arts as like a building site. And I don't know if you've ever worked on one, but at tea break, all the chippies go in one corner, the plumbers, the brickies, the painters, and so on. They don't tend to mix, even though they're all working on the same building. And with photographing people in the arts, it's the same thing. You know, to photograph a director is very different from photographing a writer or an actor or a dancer. And actors are very specific because the problem they have is their instrument is within themselves. They use their instrument, of course, in conjunction with texts, which are provided to them. But they don't have, like a sculptor can work on a material outside of himself, or a musician has an instrument which is clearly there in their hands. The instrument is within themselves. for the actor, which of course leads to all sorts of other issues, like people getting, you know, actors can be really difficult sometimes. And they're too obsessed with themselves, but they have to be involved with themselves and using the word selfish in a positive way in order to understand how to illuminate aspects of human nature, which after all is what their job is. And I think actors are very useful in society at the moment. Their status has risen hugely in the last 50, 60 years because they perform a function of helping people to know how to live. You know, in the old days, if you went to church, for example, every Sunday, you go to have moral instruction of how to deal with moral crises. And that's all fallen away for a lot of people. And therefore, things like soap operas are incredibly useful, and they're very popular for that reason, because if there are very dramatic incidents in the story, you watch how the story unfolds and the consequences of it. And the actors are the ones who have to make it convincing so that you can learn from it. And the public has confused one and the other, so they think the actors are the people they play, which of course is not true. But I do tell a lot of actors, you know, what you're doing is, you know, you've got power in society at the moment because you're helping people. You know, without these moral stories, these stories, we'd all be at a loss to know how to cope with certain things. Is my opinion.
I'm glad you mentioned people thinking that actors are their characters, because your work on The Half is showing actors as themselves. For anyone that's not familiar with The Half, would you mind explaining, firstly, what The Half is for an actor, and secondly, what your work is for The Half?
Okay. The Half is an expression which actually refers to 35 minutes, but it's actually the half an hour before the curtain goes up in a theatre. When the extra 5 minutes is added on by the company managers because they don't really trust the actors and they think they should all, you know, it's like when you say someone the deadline is Tuesday, the actual deadline is Friday. So everyone has to be in, if the play starts at 7:30, you have to be in at 5 to 7. The 15-minute call is 10 past 7. The 5-minute call is 20 past 7, and beginners is 25 past 7. So it's a way of structuring the immediate period of preparation before all the elements of the production come together and you face your audience, which is live, and they paid money to come and see you, so they're quite, you know, they demand a good high standard. So you can't sort of bluff acting in the theatre when it's live. And The Half also means that anybody who's not connected to the production, members of the public or friends, whoever, have to leave the building, and the actors are expected to be in the building. And each, if you're lucky, you have an individual dressing room. Many people have to share, but supposing you're of a certain, you know, you have your own dressing room, it's a physical place which allows the psychological negotiation between yourself and the fictional character that you're going to play. And during the period of time leading up to the beginner's call, you have to somehow, they have to get into the skin of the fictional character. And every time they do that, it flickers, you know, it's sometimes easy, sometimes less easy, depending on what's happened to them during the day. So they can use what's happened to them during the day, which is useful for the fictional character, or they can't use it, meaning they have to contain themselves. If they've had a bad day and it's an up character, they can't get all morose, you know, for the character. Yeah, there was an example, I'm trying to remember her name now, a famous American actress who was over here doing a mummet, who I photographed, and her character was a ghastly character. You know, someone who this trying to manipulative character, and she found it difficult to play because she was over here in Julia Stiles. She was over here in London having such a wonderful time during the day. It was difficult to play it all down and be miserable in the performance. So the negotiation between the personas themselves and the persona of the fictional character is what I photograph in the half. The point is that they can't, you know, at some point they have to say, right, I'm going to get into the skin of the character. And that what I'm trying to do is take pictures when that happens, because it's just doubly photogenic, you know. What makes somebody photogenic is the relationship they have with themselves and their own head. So if they're also having a relationship with their fictional character, it's just, you know, and I know enough about that process and actors to know when it's really happening, as opposed to people who might be offering pictures to the camera as a good image, which is one way of saying posing, you know. In the half, there comes a point where they have to do that job, and there's no escape, and they have to go on stage and face another 800 strangers or whatever. And if they don't do it well, they're going to mess it up. So I'm trying to look, you know, I'll take the pictures if they're offered to me as a sort of pose. I have to keep into the rhythm. But the ones that come through into the book or the exhibitions are the ones that where the actor was hardly aware that I was taking the picture, because they're engrossed in their own thing, stuff, you know, inside the head to become that fictional character.
Where did the inspiration come from for the half? Do you remember where you were when that idea
clear,
and the seed started to form, so to speak?
Well, no, well, it was when I was at that period when I was back at the Lyric Theatre Hammersmith, working on the bar very badly for 2 years, itching. You know, I could hear, I just loved the buzz of the theatre. All I was getting was people coming out of the auditorium and saying what a great play it was. And I wasn't really part of it. So at the time when I had bought that camera to do the Russian production, which was coming up, the play that preceded that was Charlie's Aunt, which is a farce, and Griff Rhys-Jones was the lead, and he was playing the very ebullient character, Charlie. And it was a fantastic triumph, and I'd seen the play because they gave us a ticket to go, and everyone had a ticket. And the point about farce is that the skill is to get the waves of laughter to keep on breaking onto the beach, if you like, to keep it on coming one after the other. And there was a top, the biggest laugh of all, was at a certain point, and I brought it upon myself to illegally climb the lighting rig at the front of the stage, hopefully not to be seen, and take my first ever production photograph of that moment of the best gag of all in that production, Charlie pours milk into the top hat of the father of the girl he wants to marry. Big laugh, fantastic. So I got that, and it gave me such a buzz, and I managed to coming down off the rig safely. A couple of days later, I wanted to photograph the second biggest laugh, when he sticks his head through a window, and the timing of which is, you know, not good for him in the story. So there's a big laugh. So I said to Griff, would you mind if I photographed you behind the flat, preparing to put your head through the window for that laugh, for that gag? He said, yeah, of course. Okay, come on. Let's do it. So I took a picture of him doing that. And he was psyching himself up to be this very ebullient character. And then I thought, well, let's go one step further back and ask him if he wouldn't mind I could take a picture of him in the dressing room. And he said, yeah, okay. So we did that, and it was my first ever session. And what surprised me was something fairly, it's a cliche, really, the atmosphere in the room was quite melancholic and not at all ebullient, like the character that he had to play. You probably know Griff's work. He can do this very jolly sort of character. But in the dressing room, it wasn't like that. So I took some pictures there, and it's there and then, and I thought, this is something I want to explore. And I knew it could be a book. It could be something, you know. But it wasn't until 2009 that I actually managed. I had my first exhibition of this subject in 2005, and I put out 48 images at the Theatre Museum, and people thought, my God, what's this? You know, this is a sort of an image that's in between formal and informal. They're not snaps, but they're not in the controlled environment of a studio. But there are whole stories within the images. And that led 4 years later to someone wanting to publish the book, which is 310 pages, and getting exhibitions around the world, I suppose.
When you first approached Griff to take his photograph behind the flat, how well did you know him, if at all, at that
point?
Not
at all. No, I didn't. I didn't know him. That's a good question. But it's just instinct, really. You know, I make assessments of, I mean, you know, when you're with people you can, who are open, you know, who are not trying to have one over you. And if they trust you, me, that I'm genuine about if they're an actor or a famous actor and I'm genuine about wanting to have a connection to them, they'll sense that. Griff was a great first choice because he's an open person, and anybody who's genuinely interested in knowing about what he does, he will give them a chance to explore it. You know, he's not so wrapped up in himself that he'll miss the opportunity to have a connection.
I guess the reason I ask, did you know him before you approached him? Because it takes, whether you felt it or not, it does take a lot of courage to approach someone who is in a very high profile position, particularly in the theatre. If they're playing the lead, they're in a very high profile position within that environment. And since then, you've photographed some of the most famous actors in the world, some of the most well-known names. How do you go about approaching those actors? Because for some people, they would assume, oh, they're too hard to reach, and even if I did contact them, they would never say yes. So how do you go about approaching them to shoot the half?
Yeah, it's accumulated from that moment with Griff. I mean, if the work itself is speaking for itself, people want to add to it, I guess. But there have been all sorts of experiences along the way with, I'm in the 80s, you know, trying to approach some of the really famous people. I mean, there was a key point in 86, I think it was, when I approached Anthony Hopkins. He agreed to do it because I dropped a letter off for him. And then he changed his mind. And I think I wrote to him saying, how dare you, how dare you let me down? You know, I explained that this is a project to promote theatre as live performance, and you're one of the senior members of your profession. You know, what's going on? So I was cocky enough to do that. And I was at home in the evening a couple of days later, and he rang up. You know, this is four emails and everything. He rang me up, and there he was on the other end. He said, you obviously want to do this interview. I'll see you tomorrow at a certain time. You know. So in those days, I used to record interviews, or try to, with the actors, before I realized that, you know, a lot of actors will say similar things. So I just get to the pictures. But he gave me a good 2 hours, I think. And it was the first interview he'd given, not officially to a newspaper or anything, but since he'd come back from being in America, about why he'd come back. And it was just a fantastic experience for me. And that made me just feel, you know, the actors want to, if they'll give you the time if if you're on the right track. You know, you're not trying to make money out of them or make them look bad. You're on their side. And I personally think that actors are on the front line of theatre long after the glamorous opening night is gone and the director and the writer have gone on to other projects. The actor has to stand and deliver every night. And I really respect that. I think it's good. Even especially if production's not as successful as they wanted it to be.
I enjoy that you almost said to Anthony Hopkins, "How dare you let me down?" That is a wonderful story.
Well, I did. I was very. I was naively cocky. But I'll tell you, no. Actually, he said to me, you know, he made the point about being. And let me try and tell the story correctly. He's more tempered now because he's been knighted and he's rich and so on. But in those days, he was really quite an angry, passionately angry man in a good way. And he would give a few talks in America, I think, to students. And he would tell them that he wouldn't put up with any nonsense from the director, which is, of course, why he left England to go to America, because he was in a rehearsal with John Dexter. Dexter was kind of manipulating him in a way that Hopkins didn't approve of. He didn't like it, you know. So he just walked out of the rehearsals in the middle of it and went to America, regardless of what the consequences would be. And the students in America said, "Well, it's all right for you, Tony. You know, you're Anthony Hopkins." And then he said to me, "Fuck that, you know. I'm not Anthony Hopkins because I'm Anthony Hopkins because I make myself do what I want to do. You know, I make the tough decisions that are good for me. And if I've got a personality that supports me, that's, you know, something I've chosen." And I totally agree with him on that. You know, and he obviously liked a little bit of fire in me to say to him, "Come on, you know, you've let me down here." And he, that's the sort of person he wants to negotiate, you know, he wants to connect with. Rather than people just say he's famous or something. He's earned, you know, he's earned. And a lot of those great actors, male actors particularly, in the 60s, you know, they're of a certain style Anthony Hopkins is the most electric performer I've ever seen on the stage. And he comes from that group. They used to drink a lot. You know, they go on that night and be drunk sometimes, which wouldn't happen at all these days. But at least they really, really lived I'm not condoning swearing and all the kind of bad stuff, but they took the bull by the horns. And when I took pictures of Peter O'Toole, who was another one of that group, his memorial service at the Old Vic, when sadly he died, I think it's 2013, something like that, and I was chosen to do the, and the people who turned up for that were interesting. You know, Albert Finney showed up, and you know, I was astonished. I mean, the technical rehearsals went on, started at 10 o'clock, and they would go on to about 5, and then the performance would be in the evening, and Finney was there at 10 o'clock, sitting to the left of the stage, just, you know, he hadn't done a lot of acting up until that point, in that recent period. He was looking at that stage, and thinking, that's where he did his Hamlet and so on. And he was sitting there, and all the other actors, like Kevin Spacey and that lot, would, one by one, at different parts of the day, come over to him to sit at his feet, you know, because they knew that he was the one of that group: Peter O'Toole, Albert Finney, Nicole Williamson, Richard Harris, who just had electricity when they performed, you know, very special. It's all been tempered down now. There's very few people around who've got that. But they did pay a high price. You know, the Richard Burtons, and it was a little bit before Peter O'Toole, you know, they burnt out. Course, but you know what I mean. This is, and Hopkins was one of those. That's why I wanted to meet him, and I got a blast of it.
There's a wonderful book, actually, and I'll put a link in the show notes for anybody that wants to find it, called Hellraisers. I don't know if you've read it, and it's the...
No, I haven't, no.
It's all of the old stories from Richard Burton, Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole, and Oliver Reed. It's and some of the things, as you say, that they got up to in the theatre were...
Who wrote it?
It's Robert Sellers.
Robert Sellers, okay.
Robert Sellers, and it's an incredible book. It's a real insight into, for someone like myself, who looks up to those actors and their work, it's incredible to read their stories and what they got up to.
Well, you know more about it than me, then, probably.
Oh, I don't know about that. I don't know about that, but it's a wonderful book. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Hellraisers.
And
is it Sellers, A-R-S, or E-R-S?
It is Sellers... E-R-S.
E-R-S, yeah.
It's very good. I highly recommend. What's the most creative way that you have approached an actor? Because there's a lot of gatekeepers, particularly nowadays with agents and publicists and people that don't want you to get close to actors. What's the most creative way you've approached someone to shoot the half?
I don't know. Going back to the previous answer, in the sense that it's been cumulative. So it's become easier because they know what the work's going to look like, especially with exhibitions and books. But creative work, I don't know, I was fairly straightforward, I think. I just wrote a letter, dropped it off at the stage door, and give them a chance to read it, mark it as work rather than as fan mail. And two or three days later, I'd turn up and try and meet them as they came in and say, you know, would you like to do this? And most of them said yes. I mean, in New York, when I did some sessions for a couple of years, it was much more difficult because, the level of protection around actors there is higher, and the stage door keepers are not nice, cuddly Labradors. They're Rottweilers, you know. They won't let you go anywhere near, which is a bit disappointing, to be honest with you. And I took pictures of, and you know, it's similar to the political, you know, the English constitution is unwritten. It's all done like there have never been any contracts between me and the actors. There's never been any money changing hands. It's all done on trust. But over there, that's much more difficult. It's all laid down in stone. And when I went to take pictures of Angela Lansbury over there, one of my first trips to New York, I had taken somebody with me. She was my girlfriend at the time. So that was lovely. But she was acting as my assistant as well. And we'd taken along one light in a suitcase to do the sessions. And we got to, Angela was the first one, I think, and the company manager said, no, you can't do that. You know, you can't have an assistant. You can't plug it in, all the rest of it, because of the union rules and so on and so forth, doing something out of a job or something. Angela got wind of this because her door was open. She came out and told them to basically F off, you know, because it was so ridiculous, you know, how the effort that we'd taken to get there. And she was royalty, you know. She had enough power just to say, oh, for goodness sake, you know. Sadly, I was in Tesco yesterday, and her agent called me up to confirm that the pictures I took that day are okay for the new book. But she's had a fall and broken her leg, which is a shame. Age 95, and we wish her well. Very much, because you know, when you fall at that age, it's not as easy to recover.
No, it's not. And as you rightly said, we all wish her well and wish her a speedy recovery. How do you select the actors that you want to shoot? Is it purely down to the actor, or is it a combination of the actor and perhaps the character that they're playing? So, for example, if Judi Dench, say, was performing in Peter and Alice at the Michael Grandage Company, but you knew that later on in the year she would be appearing as Lady Macbeth, would you prefer to shoot her in one role rather than the other? Is that ever a factor?
There's so much, many elements to that question. First of all, the reason that I choose the actors, first of all, I like them as people. And maybe there's something about their acting style as well. And for the aggregate narrative of the half, I'm trying to find as many archetypes as possible and, you know, different kinds of characters that represent human nature. And actors, on the whole, if they're lucky, they're really, really lucky, fortunate, they can represent 2, 3, maybe even 4, and they're a genius, really, archetypes of human nature. So it's not because someone's famous or not famous that's not relevant. It's because I'm drawn to them personally, having followed their work maybe, but not done any research as such on them. So I don't go into the room thinking, oh, I've got to reveal their soul through something nonsense like that. I just take what I find. But the question of whether if Judy was playing Lady Macbeth, which is unlikely these days. I mean, she did that in 1977 with Ian McKellen, which I'd love to have photographed it. But I wasn't taking pictures. That was too early for me. But it doesn't really matter too much what they're doing, I think, because you're getting two elements at the same time. In other words, you're getting the actor and you're also getting the style, the genre, or whatever it is. So someone like Mira Sayal, who's known for her outrageous comedy, on the whole, I photographed her a couple of years ago when she was playing Agatha Hannigan in Annie at the Piccadilly. Now, Annie isn't a show that I particularly paid to go and see myself, but I was very interested that she was drawn to do it. So I trust the actor's instinct. You know, if she's going to do it, it's good enough for me, you know, to try and work out. And I've been exploring in the last 10 years a lot more than I did before about the connection between musical theatre and straight theatre. And it's been fantastically photogenic, you know, the musical theatre. And my simplistic theory is that, although it doesn't hold up with everything, the kinds of play, you know, the kind of classics like Ibsen, Strindberg, Chekhov, Pinter, Beckett, we all go and see the latest good, if they're good productions, we go and see them. But basically they are a reflection of pain as entertainment. You know, you go along and you pay 60 quid to see that your marriage might be a waste of time or something like that. You sit there and the idea is to take you deep inside yourself to get the hit, whereas the musicals tend to be watched by a different kind of clientele, a different audience, and they are designed to take you out of yourself. So if you're having a really bad time in your life, you don't want to be reminded of it. You want to be taken out of yourself into some sort of fantasy. And on the whole, although it's a bit of a cliche, you will have coach loads of people coming to London from other areas to the musicals. And I think it's just as difficult to perform the musicals, probably even more so sometimes, because the variety of skills, you know, singing, dancing, acting, and so on. And they have to, yeah. So anyway, if an actor I really like is doing a musical, I will go and see them. And I've learned a lot by going to music, by being informed, by people helping me to know who are the different set of actors, who are the kings and queens of musical theatre as opposed to the kings and queens of the classics, Shakespeare and so on. And I've come across a lot of interesting actors there. Does that answer the question?
It does, it does. And it leads me on quite nicely, actually, to another question which I wanted to ask. Have you ever worked with an actor who you didn't feel was being themselves but was performing for the camera during the half was offering you shots rather than allowing you to shoot them.
There's a degree of that in a lot of actors, a tendency, but I take the picture because they're offering it, so I take it. But I know that that's not going to work. You know, it's not what I'm looking for, so I'll wait till a bit maybe later. It takes you right up to the 10 or the 5 minutes beforehand where they really have got into something deeper. There are two people who are top of my list who I cannot name for legal reasons.
Of course, of course.
Who are the worst at it. And I did, one of them is that they're both extremely famous and one's even more famous than the other. And I did three sessions with him before I felt I had a picture that was worth using on my terms, because he was always, and the other person actually tried to tell me how to take a picture, which is pointless, really.
Of course. I mean, it doesn't matter who the actors are. I guess what's important from my perspective here asking you is how did you personally as a photographer manage that situation?
When you take the picture, if they're offering it, you take it. I wouldn't take, might take a second one. So they feel that, but I mean, there are different impulses. You know, if someone's really trying to help you, that's one thing. But if they're just presenting a view of themselves that they want the public to see, that's different. You know, it's something that's not as interesting as. So there's a coming together of me and them. So in the old days, I used to go in there and say, thank you very much for doing this, but I'm not a professional, really, if I'm a gardener or something. And put myself down, etc., you know, and they would help me out. But these days, I've done enough to feel that I've got the whatever it is to be on level terms. You know, they can't do what I do, and I can't do what they do. But there's an exchange. But you don't have to say anything to have an exchange, because the person might be a method actor, and a couple of them one of the conditions of being in there, because normally you wouldn't be in there for a method actor, so you don't say anything at all. That's fine by me. I don't, less work to do, in a way.
Is there one image, or it could potentially be a series of images when you've been shooting an actor where you've thought, you've looked at the back of the camera and you know you've captured something very special?
Okay, it's an interesting point. It's a legacy from film work days. I knew when I got into, maybe a lot of people say this, but when I got into digital for the first time, I was always criticizing the digital filmmakers were looking at the back of their camera half the time, you know, and I get a bit pompous about it and say, well, every time you look at the back of the camera, you might be missing an actual photograph that, you know, the person in front of you is giving you. So I don't tend to, the only time I'd look at the back of the camera during a session is right at the beginning to get the light levels right. And I need glasses to do that, and I can't wear glasses when I'm actually taking the pictures. So it's a very sort of casual, quick glance, that I'm not overexposing or underexposing too much. But I never look at it to check whether I've taken a good picture or not. It's too it's distracting and doesn't, it's the engagement with the person you're with that it has to be, to keep the balls up in the air.
Obviously, when you're shooting the half, your aim is to be as candid as possible.
No.
That's not true. Interesting, really?
No.
Sorry,
no,
I'm not
pretending to be a fly on the wall, if that's what candid means. There's no attempt to be a fly on the wall.
I'm in
there with them. They know I'm in there. We're the only two people in the room, unless the wig person, the makeup person. It's an exchange between me and them. I'm definitely not creeping around. I'm there.
So will you? Of course.
But I'm not there. It's an active neutral.
Yes.
But it depends who the actor is. Someone like Daniel Radcliffe, for example, when first time I shot him, when he was 17, I think. And he's always given me exclusives for some reason, because he likes theatre history. And I first got in touch with him through his father. I said, you know, you'll be the youngest person in this book, and so on. Are you interested? And he said, yes. So we're in the room, and he didn't really know what to say, you know, just me and him. And there were no other film people around, you know, he'd been used to on Harry Potter sets. And so I spent a lot of the time talking, which I normally don't like to do, talking about cricket, because he loves cricket. So it made him feel better, you know, made us both feel better. That's the one end of the spectrum, and then the other end of the spectrum is not saying anything at all, either because you've been asked not to, or because you think the person, I can give in one example, who's the lead in a very high-profile production, but he was quite ill. He'd been ill for 3 days, but he was determined to carry on till the end, and I saw him before the last matinee on the last day. And he was clearly exhausted, you know, and it was because he was the lead of the show, and I chose not to say anything at all because I didn't want to distract him or for him to use up any energy on my behalf, you know. But that was a feeling that I had. So the exchange is all kinds of level, on all kinds of levels, you know. But it's not candid. Does candid mean fly on the wall?
Yeah, I guess.
Candid camera. Yeah, they don't know you're there.
Yeah, but of course, they know you're there, obviously, but I guess my question, and I could have phrased it better, is will you ever direct an actor whilst you're shooting the half, or will you allow them to prepare as they would normally, and then you capture that?
Well, and it's the same sort of response to that question, really. I mean, it's... They either want to talk, they either would like to control it, or if they need directing, I'll help out. You know, some actors, I can't really mention names, but some of them will like to drive through the whole session, and that's what you're taking pictures of. Someone who likes to do that, that's absolutely fine by me. It saves me, you know, some people, ladies have told me how to light them. You know, very experienced people who've been photographed by the best photographers in the world. They know how they want to be lit, and they tell me where to put the light. And that's fine. I mean, it saves me having to make that decision. You know, it goes from that to people who are so sort of, they're pleased to be asked or whatever. I don't know how to put it. You can feel that if you want to guide somebody, you know, they might have not had a good day, or they might be not used to having the attention or something, even though they're great actors, they're not used to it necessarily. It's difficult to explain without mentioning names, but...
Of course. Well, I'll tell you what, let's move on then slightly. You mentioned that you shot with an assistant during one shoot on the half. If you work with an assistant when shooting the half, what tasks will you delegate to them? And what task?
The assistant. If I have an assistant, it's because I want to lift the lighting backstage is so awful sometimes, and I'm not trying to trying to show how awful it is, because it doesn't give any pleasure to the viewer of the image, particularly. So the assistant will be holding a light, basically, which is quite a skill. Because it's all happening very quickly, and if I find a good assistant, I'll try and keep hold of them, because I can develop a shorthand with them of where to go, and if they have to move quickly, they don't get in the way. You know, the actor mustn't even notice that they're there, really. Yeah, but they don't. There's no other, you know, photographer's assistant. It doesn't, to me, it doesn't mean, you know, I look after my own equipment and there's not much of it. I only have three lenses, and I don't to have loads of lenses to try and make something look more interesting than it really is through composition.
Mm. Once you've put the camera down, how would you like to be remembered as a photographer, and how would you like your work to be remembered?
Someone who contributed to understanding aspects of human nature through, I mean, the photograph is, you know, again, they're not all taken in 1/25th of a second, but if you take that as the average, it's the perfect short story. And in order to take that picture, your head and your heart have to come together in a very short space of time. And if the pictures are iconic, they achieve a level of interest beyond the style of, you know, of the photographer themselves. You know, that very simple picture of Don McCullen's that's well known. I think it's, do you know the 1,000-yard stare?
I don't know the 1,000-yard stare, or I'm certainly not familiar with it. But I can.
Well, it's a picture of a soldier with his helmet on, clutching a rifle in front of him, staring at the camera. And it's a very, very simple picture, but it's one of the most famous pictures in the history of American war photography.
Yes, I've seen the image before.
Yeah, well, that for me works on two levels. It's a very cold picture. That's why it's so effective. Because he's obviously overcome by... Have you got it in front of you?
I do, yes, I do.
Oh, great. So he's overcome by the incident itself, which is basically he'd come back from an ambush and all his friends and comrades were killed and he was the only survivor. So he's shocked by that. But it's also, he's a soldier, so he doesn't want people to know that he's afraid. So that the narrative tension between the two and the eight, in terms of how much you reveal or conceal to the camera, is operating there. And you don't, I mean, it's become iconic because it's useful, you know, rather than everyone saying, oh, what a great photographer. Do you know what I mean? Don McCullen is great because he got that moment in, he's not trying to show off, you know, he felt it and took it.
You've half partly answered what my next question was going to be, actually, which is great.
Go for it.
Why photography? Now, I know that is extremely broad, but for me, for example, I think there's, if you see a moment and you capture it, it's there forever. If you see that moment and you miss it, it's gone forever. Mm. And I think that for me, it's as simple as that for me. It's unique. Every picture is unique. Why photography for you?
Well, it suits me. You know, I've knew earlier on that I had to be, for my kind of work, for what I wanted to do, I had to be relatively educated so I've got, you know, 2 degrees and an MA at the end of the day. One's politics and philosophy, one's photography, and the other's MA in film. Now, all of that feeds into my head, so I know decisions that are being made by the people I'm photographing, but also the heart side of it is in tune with that because as I said earlier in the interview, the opportunities have come my way as I've developed as a person. But I've chosen photography because it suits me because I can bring all of that together in a visual way. I'm not really a text person. I'm a sound and vision person, and I'm a failed musician. Yeah, I forgot to mention. That's what I wanted to do in my 20s. And photography sort of fell into my lap through wanting to be a director in the theatre, and then realizing that to be a director in the theatre, you have to have loads of projects you want to do. It's not just having fun with the actors in the rehearsal room, which I could do very easily. It's having one project after another, which is something I'm not, I didn't do a degree in English and go to Oxbridge or something. You know, a lot of the people who are directors have done that because they know what the canon is and they're interested in working on that level. I wasn't such a good gardener because I was too impatient. So with the photography, I was okay as a gardener, but, a better photographer. With photography, it's relatively, it's very instant. But in order to create that perfect short story in 1/25 of a second, you have to have a lot of, you have to put a lot into it from your head and your heart. And that appeals to me. You know, I'm not going to spend hours working on a sculpture out of marble or something like that. It's just not me, really.
That's okay. What is the most, what is the most important item in your kit bag?
The back of the camera, probably. You don't have that, you can't take a picture. Do you mean technically?
No, not. It could be absolutely anything. So the back of the camera.
Yeah, I think that, in my kit bag, as I say, I only have four lenses. One of them I don't use very often. I have this sort of camera, which in my opinion is, it's an old metal Canon 1DS Mark III, which is a bit like having one of those lovely old Jaguar cars that were made of metal in the late 60s, that was used in With Nell and I. Yeah, if you get hold of one of those, you don't have to keep on replacing it. And I've dropped it a few times, so I'm sorry to say. But it, keeps on going. yeah.
If someone had £50 to spend to improve their photography, how would you advise they spend £50 to improve their skills?
You can't get a piece of equipment for £50. You can go and see a play, I suppose, but go and choose the play. I mean, tickets are about 50 that will knock you off your feet and inspire you to, get involved in that world, I suppose. I can't see, £50 doesn't go very far these days.
It doesn't, but I actually think that is a lovely way to spend it if you want to become a theatre photographer, to go and be inspired by the thing that you want to photograph.
Yeah, choose the either the play or the actor that you want to see. Hopefully you won't come out disappointed. But
I think that's a lovely way.
It's a tricky thing with the theatre.
It is. I think that is a lovely way to end our conversation. Yeah. Simon Anand, thank you ever so much for your time. That was my conversation with the wonderful Simon Anand. I have wanted to speak with Simon for a long, long time, so I'm extremely grateful to him for taking the time to come here on the show. And as always, I hope you enjoyed listening to him as much as I enjoyed speaking with him. If you'd like to find out more about Simon, you can find him on Instagram at Simon Anand Photography or visit his website www.simonanand.com. That is Anand, A-N-N-A-N-D. If you're enjoying the Stand Up Photography Show, please subscribe and download future episodes on all the usual channels. And if you can find time to leave a review, we would absolutely love to hear what you think of the show, but more importantly, what you'd like to hear more of in future and from whom. This show, remember, it's all about you. It's about making you a better photographer. So if there is someone you'd like to hear in conversation, please let me know by visiting thestandoutcompany.com/podcast. That is thestandoutcompany.com/podcast. Now, thank you to everyone who has submitted guest requests so far. We've managed to secure some pretty fabulous guests for the coming weeks and months, and it's only possible because of your feedback. I'm really, really excited to reveal who we have got coming on the show, so please stay tuned over the coming weeks. There are some absolute gems. If you do find time to leave a review, remember to leave your Instagram or Twitter handle, because I would like to thank you personally, like Psycho, that is Psycho,
not Psycho, who said, 5 stars, love this podcast, Matt really knows his stuff, and makes this a must-listen for anyone getting into photography. Subscribed. Full stop. Psycho, thank you very much indeed. If there's anything that sparked your interest during our conversation, you can find the show notes over at thestandupcompany.com/podcasts, where you'll also find links from the episode. For now, thank you very much for joining me. I've been Matthew Walker. He has been Simon Anand, and you have been sensational. Until next time, take care. Ladies and gents, boys and girls, before you dash off to enjoy the rest of your day, would you enjoy maximising your photography work and photography lifestyle in one short email? That's right. Every single Friday, I will be sharing things that I've discovered from speaking to photographers on the show. It could be software recommendations, articles, book recommendations, videos we've shared. You name it, it's in there. It is a short, sharp shot of goodness that could make a big difference. It's cheesy, but it's true. So if you want to receive that email, head on over to thestandoutcompany.com/podcast, drop in your email, and you will receive the very next one in your inbox every single Friday. For now, stay safe. I'll see you next time. Take care.